Do we have a way to avoid having Barrett's esophagus go to esophageal cancer?
Does measuring a hemoglobin A1C predict cardiovascular events in people that don't have diabetes?
More information about e-cigarettes.
In university students, does a web-based screening and intervention program decrease drinking problems?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on March 28, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
Rick, I'm sure you would predict that I was going to start with the story on the e-cigarettes. That's in JAMA Internal Medicine, but also an FDA warning regarding these particular devices. How would you like to start?
Well, let's talk about this study first, and I'll let you introduce the FDA warning. There's a significant amount of controversy about whether the use of e-cigarettes actually can improve smoking cessation. There have been no randomized trials to date. So this is a longitudinal study of a large number of patients that smoke cigarettes. This is 949 participants who participated in a web-enabled panel. And they ask them, other than cigarettes, have you used electronic cigarettes in the past 30 days, even if only done once? And then they looked at the number of cigarettes used per day and whether people quit smoking over the next 6 months. In fact, even whether they intended to. And they correlated that with e-cigarette smoking. And what they found is that among e-cigarette smokers, there were significantly more women, younger adults, and individuals with less education, but that baseline e-cigarette smoking was not associated with either a greater intention to quit. It wasn't associated with a decrease in the number of cigarettes smoked per day. It did not significantly predict ability to quit.
Once again, then, some pretty, I will call it depressing evidence, but I would also say evidence that, and I understand that the FDA is going to step into this realm and regulate these devices. As we've talked about before, manufacturers are purporting that these things assist people in their quit attempts, and this is evidence, of course, that they do not.
And in fact, the authors of this study report in the very last sentence that regulators should prohibit advertising, claiming, or suggesting that e-cigarettes are effective smoking cessation devices until there's good scientific evidence, and there is none to date.
Indeed. Moreover, as you've already foreshadowed, the FDA this week issued a warning saying, oops, folks, guess what? The amount of nicotine that's available in these devices can be dangerous and reported, in fact, one fatality, admittedly, a really stupid one where an adult tried to inject this liquid and died as a result, but also that if we just took a look at the amount of nicotine, children would be at risk if they consumed the entirety.
Elizabeth, what you're referring to is that the nicotine comes in a soluble form to refill these e-cigarettes. We just don't know what the potential harms are long term. So at this particular point, I agree with you, e-cigarettes should be regulated, in my opinion, by the U.S. FDA.
And I would just add one more thing to that equation, that I applaud our colleagues in stepping forward and doing all kinds of research to help to underpin this effort to get these things regulated and get them under control. Let's move then to a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association. I said, hey, is there some way we can interrupt this condition called Barrett's esophagus and its progression to esophageal cancer? We thought a couple years ago that the use of antacids or H2 blockers was helpful in that regard, found out that in fact it wasn't. Now we have this idea that radiofrequency ablation of abnormal cells might be helpful.
Let me just take a step back and just make sure that all of our listeners are aware that esophageal cancer has increased sixfold over the last three decades, and it now makes it the most rapidly increasing cancer in the Western world. Esophageal adenocarcinoma originates from this condition called Barrett's esophagitis. That's a change in the tissue that results as a cause of gastroesophageal reflux disease, or what's called GERD. There's a progression. In previous studies, they've used radiofrequency ablation to kill high-grade dysplasia. The question is, should we be doing it for low-grade dysplasia as well, one of the earlier stages? Only about 1% of people progress from low-grade dysplasia to adenocarcinoma, and then some people with low-grade dysplasia resolves on its own. So hence, this study was done to assess whether intervening in this low-grade dysplasia was actually beneficial. So they took 136 patients with a confirmed diagnosis of Barrett's esophagitis, and half of them had routine care where they were just routinely followed with repetitive endoscopies, and the other half received radiofrequency ablation. They followed them for 3 years. And among the patients in the ablation group, they were able to completely eradicate the dysplasia in about 93% 40% of individuals. And in those in the control group, just the surveillance, only about a third of them resolved on their own. They significantly decreased the progression to high-grade dysplasia. It occurred in 27% of the surveillance patients and only 1.5% of the patients who had radiofrequency ablation. And it reduced the risk of progression to adenocarcinoma from 8.8% down to 1.5%.
Clearly, a few other things we need to examine here. One of them is, what's it take to enter this study? How are these people identified in order to be able to be eligible for this particular intervention?
Thanks for throwing me that softball. Of the patients referred, when they had an expert in this field look at it, it only confirmed that diagnosis in 15% of individuals. And then these procedures were done at centers that were expert.
Okay, I like it. On the other hand, I have to factor back to the development of Barrett's esophagus to begin with, examine things that are more conservative, like changes in diet, not eating before you go to bed, avoiding red wine and chocolate and caffeine and so forth. How about all of that in order to prophylax against the development of this condition?
Your point's well taken. If we can prevent gastroesophageal reflux disease, we can minimize the incidence of Barrett's esophagitis.
So for people then who have gastroesophageal reflux disease and may develop Barrett's, this is good news, but I'm going to err on the side of conservatism here and say, let's try all these other things first. Let's move then to another study in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Something that was kind of provocative. We're all trying to look for the smoking gun, the relationship between diabetes and heart disease. In this case, they took a look at hemoglobin A1C and said, hey, is this really going to predict risk? And the answer is no.
We're taking two steps back with regard to the use of a hemoglobin A1C. It can identify people that have diabetes, and people that have diabetes have a higher risk of having cardiovascular disease. And we know that people that have diabetes, the hemoglobin A1C gives us an idea of how well the condition is controlled, and the more poorly it's controlled, the more likely they are to have microvascular disease. But there's been some suggestion that even in non-diabetic patients, the use of a hemoglobin A1C can give us additional information about someone's risk for cardiovascular disease. And that's what this study addressed. They tried to determine whether adding the hemoglobin A1C information in non-diabetics could be another predictive factor in cardiovascular disease. Almost 300,000 participants, all of whom had no history of diabetes, and they measured the routine risk factors, and then they threw the hemoglobin A1C measurement on top of it. Over the 10-year of follow-up, in which they had over 21,000 cardiovascular events, the use of the hemoglobin A1C really didn't offer any significant predictive value.
Okay. And as I suggested, we're trying to all figure out, like, well, what is exactly this relationship anyway? And it seems like hemoglobin A1C is not it.
And not only did they measure hemoglobin A1C, but they measured other glycemic things as well, all of them indicating kind of what I'm going to call maybe a pre-diabetes or slightly a higher glycemic score. But again, in the absence of diabetes, the use of these things didn't add anything else to the routine risk factors that we already have.
It's always good not to have to undergo more testing, at least in my mind. And finally then, speaking of testing, let's turn to another study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, a very big problem, that's alcohol consumption on college campuses. Is it helpful to screen and also perform a brief intervention in order to get this problem under control?
Excess drinking among university students is a huge problem. We have good screening tools, questionnaires, brief interventions conducted in a physician's office, for example, with counseling can be effective, but that's seldom done. So this was a study to assess whether we could do a web-based alcohol screening and a brief intervention conducted on the web to address the drinking issue among university students. This was conducted in 7 of the 8 New Zealand universities, where they first of all took a questionnaire, and those that were considered to be excessive drinkers were randomized to either nothing or to a web-based intervention program. And then they followed these individuals over the course of 5 months. And unfortunately, what they determined was of the 5,000 students screened, there were about 3,400 that tested positive for having drinking problems. And the use of this intervention, although it was easy to do, it was ineffective.
We're all looking for, of course, that solution to this particular problem. It would be helpful to be able to find something that did help. What about, though, the identification? Would the screening arm at least be of any utility?
The screening arm is of utility, but it's really of most utility if you can follow that with an intervention that changes that behavior. Now, the things that we know that are effective, interventions that either increase the price of alcohol so college students can't afford it, or we decrease its availability. And unfortunately, although we know those things are effective, we've known it for years, they haven't been universally applied at the university level.
And sounds like a clear area where improvement is possible.
Yeah, this study is great because what it tells us is this intervention, although it's attractive and it's easy to implement, unfortunately, it's not very effective. So we shouldn't be wasting our time on it.
On that note, then, I'm going to reveal that I'm going to talk about the radio frequency ablation for Barrett's esophagus this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.